This is Audible.
Crisis 4 by Andy McNab. Read by Paul Thornley. October 1995. Monday the 16th of October 1995. The Syrians don't fuck around if they think you're invading their airspace. Within minutes of crossing the border, your aircraft will be greeted by a three-ship intercept, flying so close you can wave at the pilots. They don't wave back. They've come to get a visual ID on you. And if they don't like what they see, they'll hose you down with their air-to-air missiles. The same rule doesn't apply, of course, when friendly commercial aircraft blip onto their radar screens. And that was why our team of four had opted for this particular method of infiltration. If Damascus had had the slightest clue about what was about to happen aboard our British Airways flight from Delhi to London, their fighters would have been scrambled the moment the Boeing 747 left Saudi Arabian territory. I was twisting and turning, trying to get comfortable, feeling jealous of all the people sitting upstairs behind the driver, probably on their fifth gin and tonic since takeoff, watching their second movie and tucking into their third helping of bœuf en croûte. Reg 1 was in front of me. 6'2" and built like a brick shithouse. He was probably having an even worse time in the cramped conditions. His curly black hair going a bit grey at the sides was all over the place. Like me, before I left in 93, he had been selected to do work for the intelligence and security services, including the sort of job for the US that Congress would never sanction. I had done similar jobs myself while in the regiment. But this was the first I'd been on since becoming a K. Given who we were going in against, none of us was giving odds on whether we'd get to do another. I glanced across at Sarah, to my right in the semi-darkness. Her eyes were closed, but even in the dim light I could see she wasn't looking her happiest. Maybe she just didn't like flying without complimentary champagne and slippers. It had been a while since I'd last seen her, and the only thing about her that had changed was her hair. It was still very straight, almost Southeast Asian, though dark brown, not black. It had always been short, but she'd prepared for this operation by having it cut into a bob with a fringe. She had strong, well-defined features with large brown eyes above high cheekbones, a nose that was slightly too large, and a mouth that nearly always looked too serious. Sarah would not be troubled in her old age by laughter lines. When it was genuine, her smile was warm and friendly, but more often it appeared to be only going through the motions. And yet, just when you were thinking this, she'd find the oddest thing amusing and her nose would twitch, and her whole face would crease into a radiant, almost childlike grin. At times like that, she looked even more beautiful than usual, maybe too beautiful. That was sometimes a danger in our line of work, as men could never resist a second glance. But at 35 years of age, she had learned to use her looks to her advantage within the service. It made her even more of a bitch than most people thought she was. It was no good. I couldn't get comfortable. We'd been on the aircraft for nearly 15 hours, and my body was starting to ache. I turned and tried the left side. I couldn't see Reg 2, but I knew he was to my left in the gloom somewhere. He was easy to distinguish from Reg 1, being the best part of a foot shorter and with hair that looked like a fistful of dark blonde wire wool. The only thing I knew about them, apart from their zap numbers, was that, like me, they had both been circumcised within the last 3 weeks, and that, like mine, their underwear came from Tel Aviv. And that was all I wanted to know about them. Or about Reg's 3-6, who were already in country, waiting for us, even though one of them, Glenn, was an old friend. I found myself facing Sarah again. She was rubbing her eyes with her fists like a sleepy child. I tried to doze off. 30 minutes later, I was still kidding myself I was asleep when I got a kick on the back of my legs. It was Sarah. I sat up in my sleeping bag and peered into the semi-darkness. Three loadies, loadmasters, were moving around with orienteering torches attached to their heads, glowing a dim red so as not to destroy our night vision. Each of them had an umbilical cord trailing from his face mask, and their hands moved instinctively to make sure it didn't get snagged or detached from the aircraft's oxygen supply. I unzipped the bag and, even through my all-weather sniper suit, immediately felt the freezing cold in the unpressurized 747 cargo hold. None of the passengers or cabin crew would have known there were people down here, tucked away in the belly of the aircraft. Nor would our names have appeared anywhere on a manifest. I folded the bag in half, leaving inside the two aircrew bags I'd filled during the flight. Plastic bags with a one-way valve which you insert yourself into and piss away to your heart's content. I wondered how Sarah had been getting on. It was bad enough for me because my cock was still extremely sore, but it must be hard being female aircrew on a long flight with a device designed only for males. Or the female commander of a deniable op. I put a post-it on my mental bulletin board, reminding myself to ask her how she got round the problem. That was if we survived, of course, and were still on speaking terms. I could never remember which was starboard or port. All I knew was that, as you looked at the aircraft from the front, we were in the small hold at the rear and the door was on the left-hand side. I clutched my oxygen tube as a loadie crossed over it and adjusted my mask as his leg caught it, pulling it slightly from my face. The inside was wet, clammy and cold now the seal had been broken. I picked up my Car 15, a version of the M16 Armalite 5.56mm with a telescopic butt and a shorter barrel. Cocked it and applied the safety. The car had a length of green paracord tied to it like a sling. I strapped it over my left shoulder so the barrel faced down and it ran along the rear of my body. The rig, parachute, would go over that. I pushed my hand under the sniper suit to get hold of the Beretta 9mm that was on a leg holster against my right thigh. I cocked that, too, and pulled back the top slide a few millimeters to check chamber. Turning the weapon so it caught one of the loadies' red glows, I saw the glint of a correctly fed round, ready to go. This was my first false flag job posing as a member of Israeli Special Forces, and as I adjusted my leg straps, I wished I'd had a little more time to recover from the circumcision. It hadn't healed as quickly as we'd been told. I looked around me as we got our kit on, hoping the others were in as much pain. We were about to carry out a lift to find out what the West's new bogeyman, Osama bin Laden, a Saudi multimillionaire turned terrorist, was getting up to in Syria. Satellite photography had shown earth-moving and other heavy equipment from bin Laden's construction company near the source of the River Jordan. Downstream lay Israel. And if its main source of water was about to be dammed, diverted, or otherwise tampered with, the West needed to know. They feared a repeat of the 1967 war, and with bin Laden around, it was never going to be a good day out. He hadn't been dubbed America's public enemy number one by Clinton for nothing. Our task was to lift Osama's right-hand man, known to us only as the source, for OPSEC, operational security reasons, from on-site. His private jet had been spotted at a nearby airfield. The US needed to know what was happening in Syria and, more to the point, maybe learn how to lay their hands on Osama. As the briefing guide said, "Bin Laden represents a completely new phenomenon. Non-state-supported terrorism backed by an extremely rich and religiously motivated leader with an intense hatred of the West, mainly America, as well as Israel and the secular Arab world. He must be stopped." Once ready and checked by the loadies, it was just a question of holding onto the airframe and waiting. There was nothing to do for the next few minutes, but daydream or get scared. Each of us was in his or her own little world now. Before any operation, some people are frightened. Some are excited. Now and again I could see reflections from the red torches in people's eyes. They were staring at their boots or at some other fixed point, maybe thinking about their wives or girlfriends or kids, or what they were going to do after this, or maybe even wondering what the fuck they were doing here in the first place. Me? I didn't know what to think, really. I'd never been able to get sparked up about the thought of dying and not seeing anyone else again. Not even my wife when I was married. I always felt I was a gambler with nothing to lose. Most people who gamble do so with the things that are important to them. I gambled knowing that if I lost, I wouldn't break the bank. I watched the glowing redheads pack our kit away into the large aluminium Lacon boxes. Once we'd been thrown out and the door had closed again, they'd stow all other evidence that we had been there in the boxes and just sit it out until they were taken care of in London. Two of the loadies started a sweep with their torchlights to make sure there was nothing loose, which could be sucked out as soon as the door opened. Nothing must compromise this job. We got the order to turn on our own oxygen, disconnect from the aircraft supply and stand by. Sarah was standing in front of Reg 1, who was to tandem jump with her. She had never failed to amaze me. She was an IG, intelligence group, the very top of the intelligence service food chain, people who usually spend their lives in embassies posing as diplomats. Their lives should be one long round of receptions and recruiting sources through the cocktail circuit, not running around, weapon strong. Then again, Sarah had always made a point of finishing the jobs herself. She was masked and goggled up, looking for all the world as if she'd done this 1,000 times. She hadn't. Her first jump ever had been 3 weeks before, but she took her job so seriously that she'd probably read 10 books on freefall, and knew more facts and figures than all of us lot put together. She turned and looked for me. We got eye to eye, and I gave her an everything-is-okay nod. After all, that was part of this job, to look after her. The loadie motioned us towards the door. Our Bergens, each containing 40 pounds of equipment, were hanging from our rigs and down the back of our legs. We waddled forward like a gaggle of geese, putting weight on each foot in turn. Thankfully, the Bergens hadn't needed to be fully laden. If everything went to plan, we'd only be on the ground for a few hours. There was a pause of about 5 seconds as the loadie by the door spoke into his mic to the British Airways navigator, then he nodded to himself and swung into action. The door was about half the size of an average up-and-over garage door. Pulling out all the levers, he swung them anti-clockwise, then pulled the handles towards him. Even though I had a helmet on, I heard the massive rush of air, and then a gale was thrashing at my sniper suit. Where the door had been, there was now just a black hole. The tags on the aircraft's luggage containers fluttered frantically. The freezing cold wind whipped at the parts of my face that weren't covered by my mask. I pulled my jockey's goggles over my eyes, fighting against the blast, gripping hard onto the airframe. 7 miles below us lay Syria, enemy territory. We did our final checks. I wanted to get this jump out of the way, get the job done, and be in Cyprus for tea and toast tomorrow morning. We rammed up close to each other at the exit, the roar of the wind and the jet engine so loud I could hardly think. At last came a handheld red light from the loadie. We all joined in with a loud scream. Red on! Red on! I didn't know why. No one could hear anything. It was just something we always did. The loadie's light changed to green and he shouted, "Green on!" He moved back as we all shouted to ourselves, "Ready!" We rocked forward, trying to scream above the roar, "Set!" Then we rocked back, "Go!" Out and out we spilled, four people on three rigs, tumbling towards Syria. Being the last man, I was pushed by the loadie to make sure there wasn't too much of a gap between us in the sky. You can now freefall from an aircraft flying at high altitude, a miles from the target area, and land with pinpoint accuracy. The HAHO, high altitude, high opening technique, calls for extreme weather clothing and oxygen equipment to survive temperatures as low as minus 40 degrees Celsius, especially when a 50-mile cross-country descent can take nearly 2 hours. It has now largely replaced the old HALO, high altitude, low opening approach, for the simple reason that, instead of hurtling towards the ground at warp speed, with no real idea of where you're going to land or where the rest of the team are once you're on the ground, you can glide gently onto the target, sitting in a comfortable rig. Unless, of course, a man in a white coat has recently clipped a bit off the end of your cock. I felt the jet stream pick me up and take me with it. As the aircraft thunders over you at 500 miles an hour, you think you're going to collide with the tailplane. But in fact, you're falling and never hit it. Once I was out of the jet stream, it was time to sort myself out. I could tell by the wind force and the fact that I could see the aircraft lights flashing 300 or 400 feet above me that I was upside down. I spread my arms and legs and arched my back, bagging myself over into a stable position. I looked around. Moving your head during freefall is about the only thing that doesn't have an effect on your stability, trying to see where everyone else was. I could just about see a figure over on my right-hand side. I didn't know who it was, and it didn't matter. As I looked up, I saw the taillights of the 747 disappearing way above us, and downstairs on the floor there was nothing. I couldn't see a single light. All I could hear was the rush of air. It was like sticking your head out of a car travelling at 120 miles per hour. What I had to do now was keep stable and wait for the AOD, automatic opening device, to do its bit. The drill is just to assume that it's going to work, but to get in the pull position just in case. I thought, fuck that. I knew my pull height, 30,000 feet, an 8,000-foot drop. I moved my left hand up just above my head and my right hand down to the pull handle. There has to be symmetry with everything. If you're in free fall and just put one hand out, that will hit the air and you're going to tumble. I could see the needle on my wrist, Alty. I was past 34,000. Instead of waiting to feel the pull of the AOD on the pin, I kept on looking at the Alty. And bang on 30,000 feet, I pulled the handle and pushed my hands up above my head, which made me backslide. Which meant the air would catch the drogue chute to bring the main pack out. I felt it move and rock me slightly from side to side. Then, bang! It's like running into a brick wall. You feel like one of those cartoon characters that's just been crushed with a rock. I still wasn't particularly worried where everybody else was in the sky. I just wanted to sort myself out. I could hear another canopy cracking open, and I knew that it was near. I looked up to make sure I had a canopy rather than a big bag of washing above me. The middle 3 or 4 cells of the big mattress were full of air. I grabbed hold of the brake lines, the 2 handles attached to paracord on each side of the canopy, and ripped them from the Velcro that held them in position on the webbing straps just above my shoulder, and started pulling. There are 7 cells to the canopy. By pumping, you expose the end cells to air to quicken the process. I had a look around me now, trying to find out where I was in relation to the others. Fuck, my cock hurt. The leg straps had worked their way further up my leg, and it felt like someone was giving my dick a squeeze with a pair of pliers. Above me, I could see Sarah and Reg 1. I must have had a slow opening of the end cells, as they should have been below me. They were now spiralling past me, his right arm pulling the brake line down to get into his correct position in the stack. Sarah just hung there like a small child as he slotted in between me and Reg 2, who was below me somewhere. Being the last man in the stack, it was a piece of piss for me. I was just bringing up the rear. As long as I was directly above and just touching the rear of the canopy below me, I wasn't going to get lost, unless Reg 1 got lost with Sarah. Reg 1 would be doing the same to Reg 2, who was at the bottom. He'd be doing all the navigating, and we'd just be checking. And if the worst came to the worst, we could actually shout to each other once we'd got off oxygen. Reg 2 would be looking at the display on his sat-nav, global positioning device via satellite. All he wanted was one bar in the centre of the display. Technology is wonderful. We were travelling at about 35 knots. The canopy gives you 20 knots, and we were running with the wind, which was 15. I checked my height. Just over 28 grand. Good. Checked the sat-nav. Good. That was it. Everything was done. The oxygen was working. We were stacked. Time to get comfy. I got hold of the risers which attached the canopy to the rig and pulled myself up and wiggled my legs to move the leg straps halfway down my thighs. For the next 30 minutes, we minced along the sky, controlling the rig, checking heights and the sat-nav. I started to see lights now. Small towns and villages with streetlights following the roads out of the built-up areas for about half a mile, then darkness, only car lights giving away the road. I looked at my alti. I was about 16,200 feet. I thought, I'll just go for a few more minutes, and I'll take my oxygen mask off. The fucking thing was a pain in the arse. If I started feeling the effects of hypoxia, dizziness, I'd bring the mask back to my face and take a couple of deep breaths. By now, I was just under 16 grand. My mouth was full of saliva, and it felt all clammy. I got hold of the clip with my right hand and pulled the press stud off, and the thing just fell down and dangled by the left-hand side of my face. I could feel the cold around my mouth where all the moisture from the mask had been. I was freezing, but it was nice. I could stretch my mouth and chew my jaw around a bit. After about 10 minutes, I checked my alti again. 6,500 feet, time to start working. I put on my NVG, night viewing goggles, which had been hanging round my neck on paracord, and started looking for the flash on an IR Firefly, infrared detecting system. It was the same flashing light that you would expect to see on the top of a tall tower to warn aircraft, but these are just little handheld things that throw out a brilliant, quick flash of light through an IR filter. No one would see it apart from us, or anyone else with NVG, of course. I kept looking in the darkness. It would be easy to pick out. Bang. There it was to my half-right. We were coming in on finals. I was concentrating on keeping myself positioned right on top and to the rear of Reg 1's canopy, which was larger than mine as he had the extra weight to jump with. I heard him below me sounding like an infant school teacher. Right, any minute now, keep your legs bent and under your hips. Are your legs bent? She must have acknowledged. I pulled the NVGs off my face and let them hang. Okay, put your hands up by me. I imagined her with her hands up, holding Reg 1's wrists on the brake lines to keep them out of the way so she didn't damage herself if they took a bad landing. I couldn't see any ground yet. It was far too dark. But I heard, stand by, stand by, flaring soon, flaring, flaring. Then the sound of his Bergen thumping into the ground, and his command to Sarah, now. His canopy started to collapse below me as I flew past. My Bergen was dangling by the straps from my feet. I kicked it off, and it fell beneath me on a 3-meter line. As soon as I heard it land, I flared too. Hitting the deck, I ran along for 3 or 4 steps, turned quickly, and pulled my lines to collapse the canopy. A body appeared behind me. Reggie's 3-6 had been on the ground for 5 days preparing the job and were manning the DZ, drop zone. Fuck knows how they'd inserted in-country, and I didn't care.
You all right, mate?
I recognised his voice. Glenn, the only one whose name I knew was the ground commander. He looked as if you'd hear Steely Clint Eastwood when he opened his mouth, but in fact what you got was softly spoken David Essex.
Yeah, fine, mate. Fine. Let's get all this shit off.
Within minutes, our rigs, sniper suits and oxygen kit had been stowed in large bin liners, and we were aboard 2 Toyota Previas. The drivers, wearing NVGs, bouncing along the desert floor, heading for a light industrial estate on the outskirts of a town less than a mile from the Golan Heights and the border with Israel. All of us were dressed the same, in green jumpsuits, with civilian clothes underneath as part of the E&E, escape and evasion plan, plus belt kit and our own choice of boots. Mine were a pair of Nike hiking boots, which we'd checked were available in any Tel Aviv high street. Glenn and I went way back. We'd done selection together in the early 80s and had got to know each other later while chatting up the same woman, who was now his wife. He was the same age as me, late 30s, had a swarthy Mediterranean look and a few moles on his face, which were sprouting hair, and he always needed a shave. Constantly smiling, he was one of life's good guys, in love with his wife and 2 kids, in love with his job, probably even in love with his car and the cat. For the last 5 days, they'd been preparing and placing an explosive attack on an electricity substation, which was going to close down the town while we hit the target. And I knew that Glenn would have enjoyed every minute of it.
We're at the drop-off point.
If we had to talk, it would be in a low whisper from now on. As we clambered from the vehicles, I motioned to Sarah for both of us to stand out of the way. We got underneath one of the small, stumpy trees which made up this olive grove, the stars giving us just enough light to move in without bumbling. The thing I'd always loved most about the Middle East was the stars. It felt as if you could see the whole universe, and so clearly. The Regis were putting their Bergens on and sorting themselves out. The glow of the town could be seen coming from the dead ground about 5 km beyond the target. The night air was cold after the warmth of the people carrier, and I couldn't wait to get moving. The driver came over, holding up a small magnetic box.
"The keys," he said. "Both vehicles. Rear nearside wheel arch."
I glanced at Sarah as we both nodded. She had a smaller burger than mine, containing her trauma kit with fluid and anything else she would need. Once the patrol kit was packed, what else went in was down to personal choice. Glenn joined us with a jolly,
"You okay?"
as if he felt he had to bolster Sarah's morale. She looked at him blankly and said,
"Let's get on with it, shall we?"
There was a pause as he let the tone of her reply sink in. He didn't like it.
"Okay, let's go."
He pointed at her.
"You, behind me. Nick, behind her, okay?"
On the track between the olive groves, I could see shadowy figures shaking out into single file. My only job was to protect her. We hadn't let Glenn in on this, but if there was a drama, the two of us were going to fuck off sharpish. We'd just let them get on with it and die. As we joined the snake, I wondered about the times I'd done jobs while in the regiment, not realizing that no one really cared. We moved off into the shadows, weapon butt in the shoulder, index finger across the trigger guard, thumb on the safety catch. Sarah was carrying only a Beretta for self-defense. We were there to do everything else for her. For about 40 minutes, we moved through wide groves. When we finally stopped, I could only hear the crickets and the wind in the trees. Ahead of us now was the target, a row of 6 or 7 low-level, brick-faced light industrial units with flat aluminium roofs and windows. The entire complex was surrounded by a 3-meter-high chain-link fence with just one entrance, which was gated off for the night. The road was lit by yellow street lamps every 30 meters, and there were floods on the fronts of the buildings, facing down the walls and lighting up the shutters. There were also lights on in some of the units, but no sign of movement. Apart from the fence, there seemed to be no security, which would be about right for units that supposedly housed nothing more serious than JCB spares. The buildings gave off enough light for us to see what we were doing, but we were still in the shadows of the grove. Glenn came alongside me and said quietly, "This is the FRV. Final rendezvous. The target, if you look at the nearest building on the left." We were looking at the long sides of three rectangles. He indicated the closest one. "You see the lights on?" I nodded. "All right. Count three windows from the left. That's where we reckon he is, or was last night." The reckon would have been a bit of a judgment call. The latest pictures we had of the source were 3 years old. I didn't even know his name. Only Sarah did, and only she could positively identify him. I could make out two small mobile satellite dishes and a wire, half-wave, dipole antenna on the roof, looking like the world's longest washing line. You didn't need that lot for road building. I sat against a stubby tree, while the patrol prepared itself, bringing out kit from their Bergens very slowly to eliminate noise. There was no light from the town to the north, which was lost completely in the dead ground. Reg 1 and 2 checked in with Glenn, then moved off. Glenn pulled an antenna out of a green 12-by-8-inch metal box and began to press buttons. I didn't have a clue what the box was called, but I knew what it did. A little red light came up, which, no doubt, was a test to make sure he had comms with whatever devices were rigged up at the electricity substation which supplied the power to this area. I imagined they'd be using a number of small standoff charges, something about the size of a Coca-Cola can, to penetrate the cast steel casings. All they'd need to do was make a hole big enough for the coolant to drain out of, and the generators would quickly burn themselves out. Sarah wanted confirmation about the target. She pestered Glenn. "Are you sure that's the building? Are you sure he's in there?" He was already pissed off with her, and told her politely that she might be in overall command, but he was the commander on the ground, so shut the fuck up and let him do his job. "Good one, Glenn," I thought. We were kneeling around him at the edge of the grove as he made his final checks on the target and confirmed the orders with the rest of us. There were no changes to the plan. It was Sarah who would give the final go or no-go now. She nodded at him. "Okay, everybody? Here we go." Glenn got his box of tricks and pulled up the antenna the last few inches. "Stand by, stand by." I heard the click of a button being pressed. There was a delay of about 2 seconds, then a bright flash in the distance, beyond the glow from the industrial units. Then, after 20 seconds, there was total darkness as the lights went out in the compound. Glenn was back to enjoying life, despite Sarah's presence. He grinned. "Okay, let's go." We moved off at a slow jogging pace along the edge of the trees. Once level with Reg 1 and 2, we turned left over the waste ground and went straight for it. They were pulling at the straight line of the cut they'd made, making a big upside-down V for us to get through. We took advantage of the darkness and sprinted the 50 meters to the target building. There was the odd outburst of hollering and shouting through an open window, nothing frantic. The voices just sounded pissed off that the power had failed, probably halfway through the Syrian version of EastEnders. Now and again I saw the glint of torchlight from inside. We reached the edge of the target building and everybody got against the wall. Glenn looking towards the nearest corner. Round that, to the left and next to the shutters, was our entry point. Sarah was between us, catching her breath and trying to keep the noise down. The other three in the crew were on their knees nearer the corner. If the door was locked, they'd have to blow it. They started to get the prepared charges from their belt kit. I watched as they worked together, slowly unwinding the det cord, which looked like white washing line, only filled with high explosive. They stood up with the charge. Everything was nice and slow and controlled. As they started to move, the door burst open. Voices were shouting in Arabic from around the corner. The door charge was quickly placed on the ground. I saw hands reach into belt kits. They would have to remove the threat, but quietly. The voices got closer and closer, and I could hear the sound of flip-flops slapping against feet. Two boys rounded the corner wearing dish dashes, arm in arm, both smoking and still shouting about something. Maybe what Grant Mitchell was up to in the Queen Vic. Two of the Regs climbed aboard them, and almost at once I heard a distinctive buzz and crackle. The boys were getting tasered good style, at the same time as being dragged out of sight towards us. Tasers are cattle prods for humans. As the two electrodes touch a body, you press a button and 100,000 volts zap through the target. They are a great weapon, as you can hold the victim at the same time as you fuck them up big time, without getting zapped by the current yourself. As the blokes got them down on the floor, I could hear them moaning and groaning under the hands that covered their mouths. They were still being dealt with as Glenn put on his NVGs. We did the same. Glenn looked back at Sarah to check we were ready. Following his cue, we moved towards the corner with Sarah still between us. It was now one of those situations that couldn't be stopped. We just had to get on with it. The fuck-it factor had taken over. We piled in through the door. A Reg secured the entry point and waited for the other two to join him, dragging the two dazed Syrians. The corridor was dark and silent. In a loud whisper, Glenn said, "With me! With me! With me!" We moved like men possessed down the breeze block passage, the world through our NVGs looking like a light green negative film. We turned right, and through the windows to our left I could see the outside of the building. On the other side, there were plywood internal doors leading, I guessed, to rooms or offices. The smell of cigarettes, cooking, coffee and the sweat of not too much air conditioning was almost overpowering. We came to a T-junction. Glenn stopped on the left, Sarah right up behind him. I came up level on the right. I wasn't too sure which way we were heading. Glenn would tell me. I looked over and he was moving his IR torch beam, attached to his weapon, to the right. I cleared the corner, moved forward 3 or 4 meters and stood my ground, waiting. I knew Glenn would be clearing the other way. I saw his weapon's IR splash against the walls as he turned towards me. Then they both passed on my left. Sarah still had her pistol holstered and was keeping close to Glenn. The floor was tiled or concrete, it was hard to tell which. All I knew was that there was an echo of footsteps and squeaking rubber as we moved. Glenn stopped and pointed at a door. He took his weapon out of the shoulder, put his back against the wall to the left, and reached for the door handle. I moved to the opposite side, weapon still up in the shoulder, ready to make entry. He nodded. I took off my safety and nodded back. He turned the handle and I moved inside, pushing the door with me. I was blinded. The MVGs were totally whited out. It was as if someone had let off a flare in front of my face. Glenn shouted, "The fucking lights are back on!" I fell on my knees and ripped off the NVGs, blinking hard as I tried to get back some normal vision. I made out movements in the right-hand corner and rolled to the left, trying to make myself a harder target. As my eyes adjusted, I saw a middle-aged guy, his head bald apart from wiry side hair. He was curled up against the far wall, his hands protecting his face, flapping even more than I had just been. As you do when, just as the lights come on, a man with a weapon bursts in on you. Fuck it. They must have had standby power. I became aware of bits of electronic machinery. PCs, screens and computer stuff all over the place, whirring and crunching now the power had returned. I lifted my weapon into my shoulder and pointed it at him. He got the message. I called for Sarah. She came in and confirmed. "That's him." She gobbed off in Arabic, and he immediately did as he was told, sitting down on the sofa against the other wall, away from the desk with all the machinery on it. He didn't move. His eyes were like saucers, trying to work it all out and listen to Sarah at the same time. From my Bergen, I pulled out 6 magnesium incendiary devices. All I needed to do was to get them sparked up and we could be on our way. It was then that Sarah pulled a laptop and some other gear from her Bergen and started plugging it in and revving things up, still talking to the source, referring to the Arabic script displayed on 2 of the screens. He replied at the speed of sound, trying his best to stay alive. I was confused. This wasn't in the plan. I tried to keep a calm voice. "Sarah, what are you doing? Come on, it's time to go." Glenn stayed outside, in the relit corridor, giving protection. I knew he would feel exposed soon, and would want to move out. After all, we'd got who we'd come for. I said, "Sarah, how long's this going to take?" She was still scrolling down the screen. I was getting pissed off. This wasn't what we were supposed to be here for. "No idea. Just do your job and keep everyone back." I needed to underline the problem we faced. "This is going to turn into a gang fuck soon, Sarah. Let's just grab him and go." She wasn't even looking at me, just hitting one of the keyboards. The source sat tight, looking as confused as I felt. Glenn was starting to get agitated. He stuck his head back into the room. "How much longer?" she said. "What's with you people? Wait." Sarah seemed gripped by the information she had before her. I walked towards her, trying to be the good guy. "Sarah, we've got to go. If not, we're in a world of shit." I grabbed her arm, but she pulled away and glared at me. I said, "I don't understand the problem. We have the source, so let's grab him and go." We were inches apart, so close I could feel her breath on my face as she spoke. "There is more to do, Nick," she said, slowly and quietly. "You don't know the full brief." I felt ridiculous. Very near the bottom of the food chain, as usual. I'd obviously been shown only one piece of a much bigger jigsaw puzzle. They'd justify it in terms of need to know or OPSEC. But the real reason was that people like me and Glenn simply weren't trusted. Just as I took a step back, the silence was broken by shouting. Then the distinctive signature of AKs on auto, their heavy caliber 7.62 short rounds flying around outside the building. "Shit! Don't move!" Glenn shouted into the room. We had gone noisy. Not good. He left us and ran down the corridor. I closed the door. I could hear the lighter sound of Car 15's returning fire, and lots of shouting from our guys as well as the Syrians. It didn't matter that the Syrians could hear us shouting in English. There was now so much gunfire and confusion that it was irrelevant. Much more important was to get the communications right. I tried to sound calm. "Sarah, time to go." She turned her back on me and carried on working. Our new friend on the sofa was getting more worried by the minute. I knew just how he felt. There was another exchange of fire outside. "Fuck this, Sarah. We've got to go, now." She spun round, her face tight with anger. "Not yet,"
She almost spat the words. She jabbed her finger towards the direction of the contact as more rounds were fired. That's what they're paid for. Let them get on with it. Your job is to stay with me, so do it. Glenn was at the end of the corridor, screaming to me at the top of his voice. Get them out! Get them out now! I moved across the room towards the source. He was curled into a ball like a terrified child. I grabbed his arm and started to drag him off the sofa. I hadn't even put on the plastic cuffs. Let's go, Sarah. We're going. Now. She turned. And as she did, I realized that she was drawing down on me. Her pistol aimed at my center mass. She stepped back so there was too much distance for me to react to it. My new friend didn't want anything to do with this. He just stood next to me, his arm still half elevated by my hand, gently and calmly praying in a low Arabic moan as he waited to die. Sarah had had enough. Sit him down. She said something in Arabic which must have been to the effect of, shut the fuck up, because he jumped back on the sofa. She leveled her eyes on me again. I'm staying here. What we are doing here is important. Do you understand? It doesn't matter who it is. If somebody's pointing a gun at you, you get to understand very quickly. Whatever her agenda was, it must be important. She turned calmly, holstered her weapon and went back to work on the keys. I had one last try. Can't we just take him, plus the computers, and fuck off? She didn't even bother looking at me. No, it has to be done this way. I couldn't do both, take her and the source. I was still working out what to do when I heard Arabic voices inside the building. The best way to do my job and protect her was to go forward, to get out of the room and stop the threat before it came screaming in to get us. I'm going outside, I said in an urgent whisper. Don't move until somebody comes to get you. Do you understand me? I checked my mag was on tight as she looked up from the computer and sort of acknowledged. I put the AR-15 into my shoulder, and holding the pistol grip to keep the weapon up, opened the door with my left hand. The lights were still on in the corridor, and the sounds of contacts were louder to my right, but my immediate concern was the noises to my left in the corridor. I decided to move down to the next junction and hold it there. That way there would be a weapon at each end with Sarah in the middle. I closed the door behind me and started to run. After 7 or 8 strides, I was moving past an external door when it burst inwards. The thud, as it hit me full on, was as hard and sudden as if I'd walked into the path of a moving car. I was hurled against the opposite wall, stunned and winded. Worse, my weapon had been forced out of my hands. I'd lost control of it. There was yelling on both sides, me from the pain once I got my breath back, and the Syrian from the surprise. He jumped on top of me on the floor and we grappled like a couple of school kids. I tried to get to the pistol on my right thigh, but he had me in a solid bear hug around my armpits. I was pinioned with my arms out like the Michelin man. I tried to kick and buck out of position, then to headbutt him. He was doing exactly the same. Both of us were screaming. The bloke stank. He had a week's bristle on him, and it was rough against my face and neck as he squeezed and squeezed, his eyes closed, snorting through his nose as he cried for help. He was a big old boy, packing maybe 16 stones of solid weight. I needed help too, and screamed for Sarah. There was no way she couldn't have heard me, but she didn't respond. I wasn't entirely sure what this boy was trying to do, whether he wanted to kill me or if he was just fighting to protect himself. I yelled again, Sarah! Sarah! He responded by lifting his head slightly to scream out even louder. It gave me a momentary window. I headbutted him, trying to make contact wherever I could. He did the same. Then something happened that moved the situation on. You don't normally feel pain during a fight, but I felt a stinging in my left ear. His teeth were sinking in. I could actually hear the skin break, and then the sound of him straining to bite harder. The fucker had a gristly bit of my earlobe in his mouth and was starting to pull his head back. I felt the capillary bleeding at once, warm and wet, splashing the side of my cheek as his heavy breathing spat it out. He was in a frenzy, growling at me through clenched teeth, snot and saliva. I was still trying to get my hand down towards my leg so I could reach my pistol, which wasn't helping keep my ear intact. I managed to get my legs around his gut. I tried to squeeze, but could only just about get my feet together. I felt the snorting from his nose move away from my face slightly, which wasn't good news for my ear. Then his head jerked back, taking part of the lobe with him. The pain felt like a blowtorch on the side of my head, but now that he'd moved back a bit, I could start to get my hands around his head. I could see the blood on his face and snot running down from his nose as he fought to breathe through his still gritted teeth. My fingers reached his eyes, and he squeezed me up even more, shaking his head and screaming as I began to get a good hold on his face and dig deeper with my thumbs. He tried to bite my fingers. I moved my right hand so I had a flat palm underneath his chin, then switched my left to just below the crown of his head and grabbed a fistful of his hair. You can't just whip a head round to break someone's neck. The design is too good for that. What you have to do is screw it off, as if you were untwisting the cap on a jar of Marmite. You're trying to take the head off at the atlas, the small joint at the base of the skull. It's relatively easy if you're doing it against somebody who's standing, because if you get them off balance, their body is going down and you can twist and turn at the same time, so their momentum works against them. But I couldn't do that. All I could do was keep my legs around him and try to keep him in one place. I managed to get my boots interlocked, and at last I could squeeze and push down with my legs, at the same time twisting up with my arms as hard as I could. I kept on turning as we both screamed at each other. The fucker didn't like it. He knew what was going on, but fortunately for me, he was too old and too fat to do much about it. His neck went without too much of a crack. He slumped down, and there wasn't much noise coming from him. There wasn't even a body jerk. He just went very still. My hands were covered in blood, snot, and saliva. I rolled over and kicked him off. My weapon was only about 5 feet away. I picked it up and checked that the magazine was on tight and that I still had a round in the chamber. I started to move back to Sarah, then stopped. I ran back to the Syrian. I could hear firing again and people screaming and shouting, both Brits and Arabs, maybe just 30 meters away. It's funny how these details take a back seat when you're worrying about other things. I scrabbled around and eventually found the piece of my ear still in his mouth. I couldn't be asked trying to stop the bleeding on the side of my head because I knew it wouldn't. Capillary bleeding goes on forever. It would sort itself out. But I would want to get the severed bit sewn back on. It wouldn't be too good with a chunk missing because I'd have a VDM, visual distinguishing mark. But worse than that, I knew a couple of people with bits of their ear missing, and it looked fucking ugly. The only alternative was to have a 1980s Kevin Keegan haircut to cover it up. I got back to the room and banged on the door. Sarah, it's me. I'm coming in. I'm coming in. Glenn was still at the end of the corridor. When he heard my voice, he shouted, "Come on, for fuck's sake. Drag her fucking ass out, now." He was right. Enough was enough. We were all going to die here soon. I pushed it open, and Sarah was still standing over one of the PCs with her laptop plugged into some other shit. I looked over at the source. He was sitting in the same position I'd left him in, as if he was watching the TV. A small amount of blood was trickling from a hole in his shirt. But it was the one in the front of his head that gave the game away. Blood was oozing out like lava flow. The back of his head lolled against the sofa. It had ballooned out slightly, but the skin was keeping all the fragmented bone in place. It looked like a car windscreen that's been punched. The glass goes out in the shape of a fist, but it's still held together. Blood and gooey grey tissue were dribbling onto the sofa. You didn't have to be George Clooney to know this boy wouldn't be surfing the net any more. Not even looking at me as she manipulated the keyboard, she said, "He tried to attack me, but he is happy. God would have sent him Sakina." She knew I wouldn't have a clue what she was on about, and added, "Tranquility." I looked at him again. He hadn't moved from where he'd been when I'd left the room, and there was no look of tranquility on his face. He hadn't attacked her. "So what? As if I gave a fuck." It was probably part of the alternative brief she'd been given. AK fire called me back to the real world. "Come on, let's go, now, Sarah." "No." She shook her head. "I'm going to be a few seconds more." The incendiary devices were still on the table. One of my jobs, unless she was going to tell me that had changed too, was to destroy any equipment on target. She hit the final key. "Okay, we can go." She started to pack herself up. I went to the sofa, pulled the source away and let him roll onto the floor. Picking up one end of the sofa and dragging it across the room, I leaned it against the bench of computers. I got the waste paper bin, scattered the contents on the bench top and added a rug from the floor and a couple of chairs. I wanted as much flammable stuff as possible near the incendiaries. I said, "Are you sure you're ready now?" It was the first time she looked at me since I'd returned to the room. I saw her studying the red mess on the side of my head. I pulled the pin of the first device and positioned it on the table between two VDUs. The handle flew off, and by the time the last one was placed, two were already burning fiercely. I could feel the heat, even through my jumpsuit. I ditched the Bergen. Everything I needed now was in my belt kit. The air was filling with the noxious black fumes of burning plastic. I grabbed hold of Sarah, who had her repacked Bergen slung over her shoulders, and headed for the door. I opened it a couple of inches and shouted at Glenn. "Coming through! Coming through!" He yelled back, "Shut the fuck up and run! Run!" I didn't look left or right, just ran for the door by the same route we'd come in. Within less than a minute, I was in the cold night air, my eyes peeled for the gap in the fence. It was pointless worrying about getting shot. I just ran in a stoop to make as small a target as possible, keeping Sarah in front of me. I caught a glimpse of Glenn behind me, plus another bloke still further back. They followed, as we sprinted towards the fence, rounds thudding into the ground around us. The Syrians were firing far too many rounds in one burst and couldn't control their aim. Reg 1 pulled open one half of the upside-down V. Sarah slid into the gap like a baseball player going for base. I prepared to do the same. I caught up with her as her slide stopped on the other side and kicked her out of the way so I wasn't blocking the gap for the other two. "Move! Move!" I expected them to do the same to me. Nothing happened. Reg 1 had already seen the reason why. "Man down! Man down!" Looking back through the gloom, I could see a shape on the ground about 20 meters away. Whoever was with him already had his hand in his loop and was trying to drag him towards the fence. Each of us was wearing a harness, a large loop made of nylon strapping between our shoulder blades, with which a downed body could be dragged or hooked up to a heli winch for a quick extraction. "Stay here, don't move." I could see from Sarah's expression that for once she was going to do as she was told. I ran out to the dragger, and between us we pulled Glenn towards the hole in the fence line. He was moaning and groaning like a drunk.
"Shit, I'm down. I'm down."
Good. If he was talking, he was breathing. I could see that the legs of his coveralls were shining with blood, but we'd have to look at that later. The first priority was to get him and us out of the immediate area. I slid through the fence, turned on my knees, got hold of Glenn's harness and dragged him through the gap. Sarah said and did nothing.